Okay. So, if you didn't already, have you guys received your grades for Project Zero from Carl? I'll spoil the surprise. Everyone got 100. Did anyone think they were not going to get 100? Don't actually raise your hand. I'm probably not allowed to ask that. So that's good. I expected everyone to get 100 in that assignment. And everyone has an NVIDIA card, by the way. Very interesting. But I didn't go to see what was the most popular one, but probably that 650 is the most popular one. I think that the price capability ratio there is probably pretty good, which is why I think a number of you have it. Carl is also grading, I'll say grading in quotes, for Project 1, so you should get feedback on that as well. And hopefully his perception and your perception align very well. And we hope that if not on Project 1, but definitely in future projects, that what you think that you deserve is exactly what you get. Like, that's our full intention. So yeah, looking forward to see how that plays out. Patch tracers looked awesome, right? I really was happy with them. I put some of them on Twitter like I did with the ray tracers. So I usually email you if I do that, and people retweet them and they favorite them and they read your blog, so you should feel really good about that. And maybe other people will start commenting on your blog too, which that totally happened. And like our final projects, you know, I had students come to me and be like, some random guy found my blog and he's asking me all these questions, and that's good. That's good for you. Let's see. So I know everyone wants to do Project 3, which is we're going to implement the rasterizer in CUDA, and that is going to go out on Friday. We're aiming for Friday. Carl's putting on some finishing touches, and we are very generous. We're giving you over 2 weeks. So it's due on Friday, then it's due 2 weeks from that Monday. That's an incredible amount of time for people of your skill level, talent, and passion. So I'm expecting beautiful rasterizers. And I also want to reiterate that the projects that we're doing in this course, we certainly have never done it here at Penn before. And I'm unaware of any course at any university where we're doing this number of projects in this short amount of time either. So if you find some of it hard, or you see some of the work being presented here and you're like, don't find that intimidating if you see work being presented up here by one of your peers and think it's good. Find that inspiring, you know. And we recognize in terms of, like, you know, final grades and things like that, that this class is somewhat of an experiment, and we believe that it's cutting edge and we're just raising the bar. And we expect you guys to do well. And if you do, guess what? Next semester, it's going to be harder. And I'm going to keep going until there's a breaking point there. So please keep stepping it up. But the reality is I can't perceive how other people will be able to compete with you on the job market for similar jobs when you have a portfolio like this. And you have the experience. It's not, you can show your pretty picture, but you got to be able to talk to your pretty picture too. And you guys will all have a great story of parallelism based on pixels versus on rays for path tracing. You can talk about that random number problem that you had. And tell me a hard technical problem you saw. There's a good one, because that's the parallelism in it as well. And then it also would allow you to sidetrack into your general path tracer stuff. So projects are looking good. Big hit. Great works so far, everyone. And I also want to give you bad news followed by the good news, right? It's Project 3, the rasterizer. We expect to be the hardest project. We expect it to be harder than the path tracer. However, we're giving you more time, and we understand that we think it's going to be a little bit harder. It's not going to be like an order of magnitude harder, but we think it's probably a little harder. You will have to use atomics a little bit for the depth buffering. But after that, we're going to start doing GLSL, which is the shading language in OpenGL. And that will be, things will, definitely for Project 4, things will be much easier. We're going to do an image processing assignment, which I am tempted to give you just 6 hours to do, but I will probably give you maybe like 5 days or something like that. But so you will get a break after. I think we're going to peak at Project 3. And the GLSL assignments will be pretty easy. And then the final project, I still got to work out the schedule in here, because there's all these GLSL projects I want to do. But if I go too long, then we're not going to have time to do the final project. And the final project is really important to me, because it's open-ended. You guys, you can take your skills and you can take your interests and you can explore a topic. And I rarely just straight up say no to a, I want to explore this. You know, sometimes I might say, do you know how hard that is? And someone might say, yes, but I still want to do it. So I'm still going to figure out, you know, I'm still working on the scheduling. So whatever I have up there for the final project in the schedule right now, don't believe it. But you'll know as soon as I know. So any questions project-wise? Cool. So I still can't get this laptop to show nice a good resolution, so I'm going to switch to this desktop. And we may finish the rasterization pipeline today, and if we don't, that's okay too, but we might want to finish in it. So far, you know, we're looking at a different way to render images compared to the ray tracing and photon map that we've done so far. And this is, I feel, for the most part, probably a review from 460, except I'm maybe going a little bit deeper and being a little bit more explicit about the various stages. And remember, my approach is just to show you the rasterization pipeline or the graphics pipeline in general. And then I'm going to show you like OpenGL ES2, and you're going to be like, that's the exact same thing that we just went over. So like, you really are learning like the foundations of OpenGL ES2 right now. And then we'll build on it, and we'll see even more stages than we see here on the left to see what modern desktops can do, in particular is geometry shaders and then tessellation shaders, which I think could make good final projects. And I'll explain what they are, of course, before I'd ask you to use them. But so far in this pipeline, we looked at the first stage, which I think is pretty simple, which is just vertex assembly. You have a bunch of vertices and maybe some index data, pull out one vertex, right? And a vertex has a bunch of attributes, and attributes have components. So an attribute might be position, color, and normal, and then a component might be X, Y, Z, RGB. And then the vertex shader takes a vertex and outputs a vertex, and its main job is to transform the vertex from model coordinates to clip coordinates. Okay, so now this is stage primitive assembly, and you might, I'm not going to say this is definitely what your code is going to look like, but you can almost look at each one of these as a kernel launch, and each one of these is going to be a separate kernel. Doesn't need to be, but that's one way to implement it. Okay, so obviously I'm going to start mapping this to hardware and go, geez, well, there's so much parallelism here, right? Because this is a GPU programming class, and we're all about data level parallelism, where we run the same instructions, the same code, the same program on a different set of data. And that vertex shader, for example, is data parallel, where each vertex can be done in parallel with the same vertex shader, the same kernel, runs on a different vertex on a different piece of data. But if that were the case, say we did transform all these vertices in parallel, eventually we need to reconstruct our primitives, our triangles, mostly triangles, but also people do lines or points. The reconstruction of a point primitive is trivial because it's just the point. But the reconstruction of a triangle means that you might have shaded three individual points in parallel, and then you got to figure out, well, can I reconstruct this triangle from these three points? So, for example, you might have done this. You might have said, okay, forget the parallelism. Three vertices came through in serial, and then you just said every three of them, well, that's my triangle. And that is the primitive assembly stage. But chances are these things all came through in parallel, and then that's a primitive assembly stage. So it's just a small synchronization stage such that you're, after the vertex shading, your primitives are reconstructed. Because like when you execute this pipeline from an OpenGL point of view, you'll have all your vertices and all your indices. And when you say, okay, execute this pipeline, it's called execute a draw call, you'll say, interpret this as triangles. Interpret this as lines. Interpret this as a triangle fan, as triangle strips or line strips. And then once you give it that, the pipeline will know how to do the primitive assembly stage. But it's just a small stage to kind of do the synchronization to reconstruct your primitives after the vertex shader runs. Okay, so now there's a couple of stages that I did not put over here because they are minor. I'm going to say, you know, they're maybe less interesting. I won't say less important because they're totally needed, but they're less interesting. And this stage, even in modern hardware, these things are burnt into the hardware, meaning that if you were programming this with OpenGL, you wouldn't necessarily do this code in, say, your vertex shader or in a piece of code that runs on your GPU. There's fixed function hardware burnt into the GPU. And we'll talk about more. I know we talked a little bit about it, but we'll talk more about how that GPU evolved, because at first it was all fixed function, couldn't program anything. And now it's very programmable. But these two stages here do more transformations on our vertices. So it took the clip coordinates output from the vertex shader, and the first thing it does is perspective divide to go into NDC, normalized device coordinates. I'm sure you guys saw this in 460, where basically the world is in this unit or in this cube, we're centered around the origin. And this is just dividing by basically the W coordinate or the clip coordinate, and this is where we get the perspective foreshortening effect. And if this were orthographic, I'm pretty sure that W will be 1, in which case it does not do this perspective divide because there is no foreshortening effect in orthographic projection. And then after that, the normalized device coordinates are still not mapped onto your screen yet, so you need to go through a viewport transform, which is just a simple scale and bias to get it from the unit cube onto the window from what the viewport transform defines. So that could be in most apps that you guys are writing. That's just going to be your entire window, maybe 00 to 640, 480 or something like that. So one thing that I kind of slid over here is I go, oh, we have this cube, but we're mapping it onto a rectangle, right? So when I go from normalized device coordinates to window coordinates, okay, so I said scale and bias, and that gives us an x and y, so we go from -1, 1, -1, 1 to whatever this is, you know, 0 to 640, 0 to 480, whatever. But I didn't say anything about the z component here, okay? So the z component isn't shown in this window, but what do you think we're going to do with it later? You could add one word after z. Z buffer. Right, so we will use the z value to resolve visible surfaces using a depth buffer or a z buffer, which are the same thing. Like when you look at computer graphics terminology, z buffer and depth buffer are the same thing. I don't know if there's any kind of like really fine point difference, but they're kind of used interchangeably, just like Direct3D says pixel shader and OpenGL says fragment shader. And it's an unfortunate, fragment shader is more correct, but it's an unfortunate difference because you have to be able to translate depending on who you're talking to. So you might do the same thing. And Z, depending on what country you're from, people also call it Z too. Cool, so these are two transforms that are built in to modern day hardware. These were not built in, will be built into your CUDA kernel. I mean, it depends on if Carl decides to give you the code or not. But we certainly would give you, for example, this viewport transform, or we will give you a function to compute the viewport transform. And if you're reading real-time rendering, you will notice a number of these images come from that fantastic book. Okay, any questions about that so far? Cool, well, let's keep going through the pipeline. So another stage that I didn't, and this is after primitive assembly. One more point here, I was just looking at. Is these two things, you might look at this and go, Patrick, it looks like you could do this in a vertex shader. So why is it done after primitive assembly? Why is it not done before primitive assembly? I don't know, actually. And I confirmed this. I looked at the OpenGL ES map that I have. And I'm not sure the decision for why this stage is done after primitive assembly. I think it really is, it doesn't matter. And I don't know if there was some fine point on why they did it, but just so if you were looking at this saying, well, geez, why is it in this order? The answer is I think it could be earlier in the pipeline. Okay, so we've assembled our primitives and we've transformed them now into window coordinates. So clipping, you guys probably saw clipping in 460. Did you guys implement any clipping algorithms? No? Okay. So sometimes the triangles might be completely off the screen and they're easy to get rid of them. Sometimes they might be cut by one of the clipping planes and that can be kind of painful because then you might have to insert. Like this one triangle now actually has to become two triangles because we couldn't render a quad. You know what I mean? So the clipping is actually kind of non-trivial. For your rasterizers, you're not going to have to implement clipping, although we'll make it one of like the optional stages if you're super interested in doing clipping. In fact, a funny, somewhat related clipping story was at i3D a few years ago, which is a popular conference for people that are doing, it's interactive 3D graphics, like ACM interactive 3D graphics. It's for people that are doing real-time rendering. Actually, probably you guys would be very interested in the papers there. But someone did a CUDA rasterization pipeline for order-independent translucency. Because traditionally, as we'll see later today, if you're doing this rasterization pipeline and you're going to do translucent objects, you have to sort them from back to front and blend them. And it's so painful from the developer's point of view. So they did a pipeline in CUDA that didn't require the sorting. From the developer point of view, basically what they did is they keep like a linked list, you could think of it, behind each pixel, and at the very end they sort implicitly, and they got better performance than and their bare rasterization pipeline got better performance than the OpenGL drivers. They were tuned for rendering. So someone got up and asked, like, how is that the case? How could you have possibly done this? And it turned out that they just didn't implement a bunch of stages like clipping, you know. So when you're only doing a very limited, if your object is always in view, then it never needs to be clipped anyway. So just an interesting aside. Okay, so let's jump back to some of the major stages that I care about. Okay, so at this point we know that our primitive, it's been transformed. We know it's inside the viewport, but we still just have the three points for it. And now we need to find out what pixels it covered. And we talked about rasterization once or twice this semester, and I'm sure Norm covered it pretty well. But now we need to figure out what pixels it covers. And I'm curious, what do you guys think in terms of implementation-wise? How would you code this? Or just tell me algorithm. You don't have to tell me the exact code, but just general algorithm approaches to rasterizing a triangle.
Maybe something like whichever color's nearest in the Z buffer you display.
Whatever color is near. So we're not. There's no Z buffer yet. This is just, think of this as the frame buffer, as a 2D buffer where each element has color RGBA, say. So go on with your idea though.
We would get kind of a parallelogram, and we have to check whether it is inside the triangle.
Okay. So that could be similar to, there's scan line approaches where you might have a bounding box and you scan left to right and say, am I inside or outside the triangle? And a scan line approach is one way to do it, for sure. Another way that's very, I don't want to say naive, but maybe it's like kind of bread and butter computer graphics, would be a recursive flood fill. So you could rasterize the lines, and then you pick a point inside the triangle, and then you could recursively look at the surrounding points. So say I'm on this guy, and then I'm going to look at all four surrounding points, and I'm going to say, like, what color is it? And I keep going until I reach an edge. So it just recurses out. Now that is perhaps impractical, let's say, to implement in hardware, but it's probably in the intro graphics book. Like, you know, it's definitely, like, you know, considered a bread and butter algorithm to look at. The other thing that I believe most hardware does is a recursive filling, where it basically does like an octree, where it goes, okay, here's my bounding box. There's a triangle in it. Yes. Break it into four. Are all four of those guys in it? Yes. Break those into four. Some of those start to fall out. Then it recurses down. And I'll probably include some papers for your assignment on ways that you can consider doing this. On today's hardware, rasterization is burnt into the hardware, which means that there's no, like in OpenGL, there's no programmable rasterization stage. You just kind of tell it what to do. You don't write the code to do it. And Larrabee, have you guys heard about Larrabee at all? Really, no? Okay, so Larrabee was a 2008 SIGGRAPH paper, and this was Intel's programmable GPU, which was a pretty big deal because they really want programmable to the extreme. In fact, maybe we'll read that paper. We're running out of time, but do you guys want to meet like 3 days a week? No, okay, I'm kidding. But yeah, I mean, no, really, we're like halfway through the semester. We're just about halfway through the semester. And, you know, we have some great guest lecturers coming. I want to do a hackathon. We have so many things going on that I'm like, what content are we going? What are we going to cover, and what are we not going to cover? So I'm kind of bummed that we're probably not going to cover like everything in my grand vision, but maybe we need two courses to do that. So Larrabee was, you know, Intel's really programmable GPU built on x86 cores, believe it or not. So not on like what you'd see in NVIDIA, and they went programmable to the extreme, including the rasterizer was programmable. The only thing that they didn't make programmable was the texture filtering, which is, if you're going to read a texel from a texture or an image from a pixel, it might have to combine surrounding pixels. And that part, they kept in fixed function hardware, because the fixed function hardware was don't quote me on their numbers because it's been several years since I read the paper, but I want to say it was like 20 times faster. And in general, fixed function hardware uses less die area and uses lower power too. So yeah, Larry, I'll put that on my list. So in terms of commercial success though, the Larrabee has yet to be realized as like a GPU, but I think it made its way in as like Knight's Corner. Does that ring a bell to anyone? Something like Knight's Corner. We have to ask for Varun. He was a TA last semester and he knew everything about it. But I think they didn't market it as a commodity GPU, but instead they made it like a just kind of like a Tesla card, like a programmable board. So what else do I want to say about that? Yeah. So while I'm talking about the fixed function hardware, which I'm sure I'm stealing my thunder from some future slide, but that's fine. There was a debate as like, as GPUs became programmable, that we'd get rid of fixed function hardware. Well, why would we burn algorithms into hardware if we can just make them programmable and then it's just more general, right? And it's easier to design. Then all of a sudden, like mobile came around and we really cared about the low power and we cared about the die space. So like the fixed function parts of the GPU, they're definitely here to stay in the foreseeable future. There's been a lot of good SIGGRAPH discussions about that. If you go to SIGGRAPH, I might have asked you before. So how many people were at SIGGRAPH last year? Okay, awesome. 4. How many think you're going this summer, SIGGRAPH? Down? Now we only got 2? Okay, so if you're CGGT or DMD, I'm pretty sure Penn gives you some amount of financial support to go. And then 2, like if you're doing computer graphics, whether that's in the movies or in the games, or even like me, I'm not in either, right? I'm in like general visualization, I guess you could call it. It is like the one place to be. Like if you only go to one conference a year, I think that it's awesome. There's a lot of energy, a lot of great stuff. But some of this course material, perhaps even a lot of this course material, comes from a course there called Beyond Programmable Shading. And those guys will always be talking about what is on the bleeding edge of GPUs. And recently they were discussing fixed function versus not fixed function hardware. Okay, now that we're back to regular rasterization. So the other thing, we talked a little bit about aliasing that could happen with, we talked about in ray tracing, or distributed ray tracing, extended a lot of rays that are jittered through one pixel to minimize it. With rasterization, we could give a whole lecture on anti-aliasing techniques, but a lot of them involve subsampling or supersampling, where you might say, what percentage, you might look at the percentage that you cover a pixel and then change the alpha based on it. And I may do like maybe a half a lecture or something on anti-aliasing for rasterization, because it's a pretty prominent. There's a million techniques and it's an area of interest. Rasterization though is not just about the positions here. It's not just finding out what fragments or pixels cover the area, but we might have not just position, but maybe we have normals, texture coordinates, colors. So what happens to those when we rasterize? Nothing? I could just drop them at this point in the pipeline? I could totally do that. But, say you have, in fact, let's just draw it out because it's pretty important. I want to make sure that it's clear. Let's say we have a triangle, so it's got 3 vertices, and each vertex, has some position associated with it and some color. And that's it. There's no normals, nothing else. So we do rasterization, we find out what pixels, or I'm going to say fragments, it covers. Everyone remembers the difference between a fragment and a pixel from day one, I think I might have said it. A fragment is a pixel before it becomes a pixel. Like, you're not a pixel until you're written to the frame buffer, because a fragment might fail a number of tests that we'll talk about, most likely the depth test. So if an object is behind an object, it's a fragment, but it never becomes a pixel because it was hidden, assuming the object in front was opaque. So I'll probably use the term fragment because I've trained myself to say fragment because it's more correct, but if that scares you, you can just think pixel and it's loosely correct. So we figure out the fragments that this thing covers, and then you might say, well, geez, what is the color right here? So what happens, and this is again in fixed function hardware, is it's interpolated based on the surrounding three colors, and this is done with, what's the word for it? Barycentric coordinates, if you guys have heard of that. So over here, you get all C0. Over here, you get all C1. Over here, you get all C2. Along here, say right here, you get some linear combination of C0 and C1. And then as you move this towards P2, you start to get some amount of P2. And it's a simple exercise. You could render one triangle with a red here, a green here, and a blue here, and you'd see the fade in between it. Okay, so my last question on this slide is the triangle to fragment ratio. So if I am going to draw a scene, you know, I don't need an exact number. You can just give me a general discussion. But how many fragments is a triangle typically going to yield? You know, here's two answers, a little or a lot. Or you can be like, this question's ridiculous, it depends. Right. So all these answers are valid. I mean, the general thing, so it really matters. Like, if you have one triangle and you zoom into it really close, it's going to generate a whole lot of fragments. If you have one triangle and you zoom way out, it's only going to generate a couple fragments. Right. Generally speaking, you will have a lot more fragments than triangles in a given scene in a game and in most real-time rendering. In the movies, you'll hear micropolygons, the term micropolygons thrown around. And you'll have very small triangles. You might have triangles that are 1 pixel or 5 pixels. And right now, GPUs aren't actually that good at handling that because you wind up with some redundant shading along triangle edges. So these guys from Stanford have proposed changes to the pipeline to improve that. And I'm unaware if they've been realized in any recent GPUs, but as of now, I'm pretty sure that they haven't. But generally, you want to think that you're probably going to have a lot more fragments than triangles. I mean, a GPU, an older GPU could do like 10 to 200 million triangles per second and billions of fragments per second, right? So they were set up kind of like that. And today, I think those numbers are much higher. And this is also going to be like your load, like the bottleneck in this pipeline can change based on your scene. If you're depending on if you zoom out or if you zoom in, you might have a different number of fragments to shade, a different number of vertices to shade, and so on. We might later, time permitting, I'd like to give you like different scenes, and then you guys optimize them, find the bottleneck, and then improve the performance. Because that's something that we do in real life, like all the time. If you're interviewing for like an in the trenches game programming job, they would love to hear about your experiences doing that. Okay, so what questions do you have about the rasterization stage, doing the interpolation? Cool. All right.
This part can't be programmed.
So if you're using like the OpenGL API or the Direct3D API, the hardware that uses to do the rasterization is built in. It's burned into the hardware and it can't be changed. Now in CUDA, we can write whatever code we want to write. You know, it will run our custom code on the SMs as opposed to using the fixed function hardware. What do you mean? What algorithms do they use? So I think most hardware does that hierarchical subdivision I told you about, where it starts with a bounding box, breaks it in four. What nodes are covered, break it in four again, and so on. In fact, I might have a link in this slide. No, I don't. I'm going to find that paper for you guys, though, so it's included in your rasterization, but I don't have I know where the link to that paper is, but I don't have it in the notes. And I think I told you guys, right, that in my slides, I usually put some notes down here. And, you know, if you're going back through the slides, like, you're totally welcome to the notes. Any other rasterization questions? Yep. How do you find out the normal?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if I stored normals as part of my vertex data, and remember, that's up to the model. However you loaded the model, it has whatever it has. So say it has normals in here, N0, N1, N2. It's the same deal as the color, where say you have this fragment, it's going to be some combination of N0, N1, and N2 based on the barycentric coordinates. Now, there's an interesting, and I probably have it on a slide here, there's an interesting thing that happens here, though, is that say my vertex shader outputs a normal, and you know, I'm really good about it, I normalized it, right? That sounds like it makes sense. After interpolation here, that normal is not normal. Okay, so in the next stage, we're going to talk about the fragment shader. You need to normalize an incoming normal if it were interpolated here. Yep.
I basically implemented that on my OBJ router, what you just spoke about. But what I noticed was I was actually trying to implement smooth normals, but then the normals weren't exactly smooth at the vertex because it was always, let's say, if the point was at the vertex, then it always assumed that the normal is the vertex. So I didn't get the smoothness that I was hoping for.
I'm not quite sure what you mean. So you implemented this in your OBJ loader, but were you introducing new points inside of here?
No. What I mean to say is, just to make the object look smooth, I thought I'd implement that, and once I did, I didn't really get the smoothness. The reason for that was that, let's say your intersection point is exactly at P2. Your interpolation is going to be such that the normal is what it is at P2.
Yes.
So it is still quite edgy.
Compared to, say, this other triangle over here?
Something like that.
Yeah, so let me give you, and this probably doesn't answer your question, but let me just give everyone like a general discussion on the some of the problems with per-vertex normals that you can wind up. So let's take an edge view on this. And here's two separate triangles that share a vertex. Okay, and remember we talked about sharing vertex with the index data. So I think you guys would agree with me that this normal is pretty good. Is that reasonable? But let's say we're still looking edge on. Now what normal do I pick? Maybe I know the normal of this surface, I know the normal of this surface, I add them, I divide by two, I get an average normal, and I get this guy. And now your shading is going to be kind of strange, because it's going to kind of go, you know, it could go dark, light, dark, or the opposite of that. So this kind of, yeah, this kind of sucks. So what you do in this case is here we are edge on again, is you'd probably break this into two separate vertices, and you'd say here and here, and you'd have criteria based on this angle, and you'd have multiple faces coming into it. And if you have like a geometric processing library, they probably have things built in that you give it parameters to say when to split the vertex like this. So I don't think that exactly answered your question, but this is like generally good to know if you haven't seen it in the past. Okay, other questions? So let's move on from the rasterization stage. So what is, I would say, what most people would consider the most interesting stage of the pipeline, which is the fragment shading. And here the idea is we've rasterized and we created a bunch of fragments, and now we need to determine the color and perhaps other data of that particular fragment. And this, just like you did with your ray tracer and path tracer, is going to do some computations to simulate the interaction of material and light. And these can be very simple, or that can be, you know, as complicated as you can imagine. And sometimes you hear this term material thrown around. If you're working on a game engine, let's apply some materials. And loosely speaking, a material can be thought of as the fragment shader plus some uniform data coming into it, some constants coming into it, just like you could have uniform data like those transfer matrices coming into a vertex shader. Sometimes materials are more than a fragment shader and the uniforms. They can be, sometimes it is the state of the entire rendering pipeline and the combination of vertex and fragment shader. Sometimes it's just terminology. And as I mentioned, Direct3D calls these pixel shaders. Which I don't feel is as precise as OpenGL terminology, because sometimes these, you might run the pixel shader, but then that doesn't actually become a pixel because it will fail one of these tests down here that we'll get to. But just for your perspective, I want you to know when you're reading something and you see pixel shader, fragment shader, that it's equivalently the same thing. So what exactly comes into this thing? Because I just, in PowerPoint, I get away with anything. I go, oh, a fragment comes in. So what you're really looking at is the X and Y value in screen space. Let me double check that. In window coordinates. And then you'll get the depth value as well, which in almost all cases is going to be 0 to 1, where 0 is really close to the viewer and 1 is really far away, based on the near plane and the far plane of the view volume. That can be configured in OpenGL, where you could set the depth range however you want. Most people usually don't do that and just use 0 to 1. If you want to know the nightmares and Z-buffer precision that can happen depending on your near and far distance, I have an entire chapter on it in my virtual globe book, and I hope that none of you ever have to deal with it. But maybe, time permitting, I'll spend like 10 minutes on it in some future lecture. But sometimes you can see these Z-fighting artifacts, where if you have a really near plane and a really far plane, and objects look like they keep cutting through each other. And it's a pain. But a lot of times games don't necessarily have to deal with that. But the type of stuff I do where it's just a big open world and there's satellites and there's ground stations, it becomes harder to restrict the view. But anyway, in terms of inputs coming into this, for the vertex shader, you know, some really good useful inputs are the transform matrices, as well as like time, for example. We talked about inputting a time that changed every animation frame to do that little pulsing effect. So for a fragment shader, textures coming into it can be used for not just for creating color, but also for perturbing the normal or any type of lighting effect like that. They're really, the sky is the limit here. And these are generally going to be a lot more complicated than your vertex shaders. And this is kind of where the bulk of the action is. And your first GLSO assignment will be just writing fragment shaders. I'll give you a simple vertex shader, and you'll write a bunch of image processing effects in a fragment shader. So let me show you some examples. Okay. I assume at this point it's bread and butter for you guys to do simple shading models like Lambert Fong, or here I'm showing Blend Fong. So, you know, here we're finding the diffuse term, light scatters in all directions. We're taking N dot L, and we're making sure it doesn't go negative. So if the light is looking straight down, it's most intense. And as it comes off to the side, it's less intense. And then for the speckler here, we're taking a half angle between the vector to the eye and the vector to the light. And then we're dotting that with N, getting the specular bump by raising it to a shininess, which, by the way, that would be a good uniform to pass in. And then here, depending on how much light reflects into the eye, how mirror type, kind of how mirror the surface is, we get the intensity here. And this Blend Fong might be slightly different, is slightly different than the Fong model that you may be used to here. But for directional light sources, this H is constant. And it can be a little bit faster than the Fong model. So you might, you know, this is like simple compared to what you did for your ray tracer and your patch tracer. But with respect to your rasterizer, I'm more concerned with you getting these stages set up in CUDA, doing the synchronization among your threads as needed. And I'll be completely okay. And hopefully Carl agrees with me in his write-up that if you do this very simple shading like this in your fragment shader, but there's nothing stopping you from blowing me away with some shading in your fragment shaders for your pipelines, including, as I said before, reusing your work from previous assignments that are yours but not your neighbor's, right? Oh, one thing I didn't say at the beginning of the class is it's the only way to fail this class is to have an academic integrity issue, right? Which I assume that I find it highly unlikely that we have any of that. Even if, you know, you tried hard but didn't get anything to work, like, I'm still going to give you a D plus at the least. So just, you know, rest assured, like, no one's in danger of failing the class, but just don't worry about that. I should have said that on the first day, but I don't know. That's my policy. So one thing that I want to say here is We evaluated, I'm showing you this simple lighting model. I showed you the diffuse and specular. And cool, you could have ambient, right? You just add the ambient term, and that's like fake global illumination. Or you can have emission, where that's kind of what does this object emit? Although it doesn't really emit because the surrounding objects aren't affected by it. But these are really cheesy lighting models that have been around in real-time graphics from, you know, the mid-90s, old commodity hardware. And now I think we're seeing a lot. These are still the foundations, but we're seeing a lot less of them because we're using more sophisticated models. But I'm telling you that we're going to evaluate this light per fragment, okay? But then you go, well, geez, you were just telling me about rasterization, and you said that we did interpolation during rasterization, and you said that there's going to be a lot more fragments relative to triangles, and therefore a lot more fragments relative to vertices. So why don't we take these two lines of code, which have some math in them, and maybe push them up into the vertex shader, way up here. Sorry, I'm jumping all over the place. And then we'll interpolate them. Right, so why wouldn't we do that? Yep?
Because lighting is a really non-linear operation. Interpolation force it into a linearity to make it reverse.
So generally, the interpolation, it makes the visual quality lower. You'd rather interpolate the normal and do the lighting computation than do the lighting computation and then evaluate the color. Come again?
Magnets.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, the Mach bands, right? Yeah. So let me show you some images here. Let's see. So here, look at the tessellation. It's the same tessellation, but you have per vertex and per fragment. And look at the specular highlight. Like, you're not getting as much of the specular highlight here than you are per fragment. And one of the things that they used to do for specular highlights, because is they used to more solely increase the tessellation for an object when just to get better specular highlights if they're doing per vertex shading. So it was like this total hack to like just change your geometry so that you had the lighting computation done more frequently. But definitely, like, when you're looking at per vertex versus per fragment, it's all about the specular highlight. You'll see a big difference. And this was, you know, everyone was looking at this, like, maybe 2006 and 2008. From a pragmatic, I mean, from the graphics research point of view, this has been talked about since, like, the mid-70s. But from, like, the, you know, people using commodity hardware, in the mid-2000s, people would really start looking at this and be like, well, geez, we should just always be doing per-fragment lighting, you know. It's just standard now. I mean, everyone does it. I think, for the most part, although I'm not really doing any mobile at the moment, but I think even most mobile people will be doing all their lighting per-fragment as well. So here's another example with the where you have a really coarse tessellation and you get more fine tessellation, and suddenly the specular highlight, of course you're right, the geometry looks smoother, right? But the specular highlight also looks a lot better. So, but with per fragment lighting, it's not an issue. Okay, so texture mapping, I know some of you actually already implemented it in your ray tracer, and I'm sure you guys all did it or saw it in 460. And the idea is you can take images, and we'll call them textures, and then you can have coordinates that map into this texture. And when you go to do your fragment shader, you can read based on those coordinates into this texture and use that to color your scene. And for example, this might just be a diffuse map where we read this to get the diffuse color and then do the lighting computation. I just want to give a couple pragmatic notes on it. What you'll see here is this entire object here, you have wings and the body, and I presume the ears or feet. All the different surfaces are in one texture, and you might see this called a texture atlas. And we do this a lot in computer graphics. It's kind of like this. It's like you go to a website, and it might have 100 different images, and it could download each image individual. Or it could have all those images in one image, and then download it, and then pull out the parts that it needs. And doing that is more efficient because there's less overhead per download. So on the GPU, there's something similar where we'll usually jam a lot of textures into one, a lot of images into one texture, and then just use the texture coordinates to pull out of it. And these coordinates are almost always normalized, 0 to 1, 0 to 1. And then we'll talk a little bit more about filtering that can happen when you go to read these. You've probably seen the term mip mapping. But texture mapping is, you know, used everywhere, bread and butter. And here's a couple of screenshots here. These are from a chapter in my Virtual Globe book. And Norm has similar pictures in 460, where here's a sphere, and it's just lit, you know, the diffuse and specular. And then here is that same geometry rendered with texture mapping, and just looks perfectly flat, right? And then here is texture mapping, where we're using the texture as the diffuse color, and now you see both. You see both color, and you see the shape. Okay, so here's another image of that globe, and then here it is with bump mapping, and we saw the mountains along South America look much nicer, and even out here, this detail was previously unnoticeable. So you may say, well, man, if we added a bunch of geometry to that, and then these mountains would have different surface normals, and we would get better shading. You know, we would see these. But this is not. This is using bump mapping, so it's still the same underlying geometry, but this bump map is a texture that doesn't have color, but it actually has height values. And from those heights, we derive normals and tangent space so that we pretend that the surface has a different orientation, but really has the same orientation, but the normal was just adjusted a little bit. So you'll see bump mapping, or similarly, you'll see normal mapping, where the normal value could be stored in the texture and then used. And I hope to do a longer talk on normal mapping and bump mapping later in the semester. You will implement bump mapping in a GLSL fragment shader to do exactly what you see here, which is add mountains to a globe that you'll make. So it's pretty cool and it was fun. The first time I did, this class used to be so easy. Like, the first time I taught this class, they did a globe, and the bump mapping was extra credit. And I was like, no way. Now, you know, then last semester it was required, and then now I don't know what else you're going to do for the globe, but you're going to do even more, right? So, but you guys can handle it. And you're going to be famous, too. I think that if we keep up in the bar in this class will be famous, and then you'll be famous for going through the class. And then I'm telling you, this is going to happen. We're going to look at computer graphics like 15 years from now, and there's going to be all these phenomenal people in computer graphics. What are they going to have in common? They all took CIS 565. Right. Okay, any questions on bump mapping here? Yeah. Yeah, so the bump map here is stored, each channel, each image, or each pixel in that texture is a height value. It's just a luminance intensity. And if you were to look at it, let's see if I can just find, I should have had one in here, but let's see if I can find one real fast. Bump map. So here's an example for bricks, where the black is showing the bottom of the surface, and then the lighter it is, the higher raised it's supposed to be. So from that, what you can do is you can look at a surrounding 2x2 region for your particular fragment, and then you can do, you have dx, dy, and dy, d, so you have the change in x and the change in y, and you kind of do like a cross product to figure out where according to the height, this thing bends, and you do that in tangent space, and then we would convert it to I space and do the lighting in I space, and I will give you some of that code too in your shader. So that's what a bump map is. Now the normal map, and there's different types of ways to do normal mapping, but let's see if we can get at least one image here. Normal map. Here you'll see a lot of these where this has the actual normal, the X, Y, Z in it, or maybe just two of the three components and we draw the third one. So that's the difference kind of in a nutshell. And like I said, I hope to spend more time with it later in the semester. Because again, it's a big topic. And then there's also techniques that are very pragmatic too. Like, Okay, so you know about normal maps, and that's great, and someone might ask you about it, but then there's ways to compress normal maps. There's ways to compress textures in general, and we're really interested in compressing textures because bandwidth is a problem, and if we have less bandwidth, well, we have so much compute that we're better off that way, generally speaking. But then compression of normal maps is kind of different than compression of regular colors because they're normals. So there's lots of fine points in there to talk about. Other questions? Okay, so anyway, I just want to point out that the fragment shaders can be a lot of code, right? And we hope that the compute to memory access ratio is pretty high. We hope that we're doing a lot of math relative to the number of textures that we're reading. It's the same thing, it's just think about your CUDA kernel, right? You want to be doing a lot of number crunching, not doing memory reads. And if you're doing memory reads, you hope that you have some number crunching that you're doing right after the memory reads. Like, here's an example of skin rendering, which is based on sum of Gaussians. And this has a ton of computation involved. But because the GPUs have so many, you know, teraflops at this point, we're able to get really good performance here. And this is approximating subsurface scattering with blurring together a bunch of Gaussian passes, which is very different than subsurface scattering. Some people did do subsurface scattering, right? I think I saw at least one or two. So this is very different than the subsurface scattering you would have done with ray tracing. Skin rendering in general, by the way, not that I'm the expert in the topic, but a great final project if you're interested in doing skin rendering. Okay, so I talked about fragment shaders outputting color. Like, you know, I said, okay, here we go. You get your fragment's XY position coming in, you get this Z coordinates, kind of like the depth value, and then you get whatever interpolated values that you gave from your vertex data. It all comes in the fragment shader, and I said, you do some code, it simulates light and material. I gave you some examples with the Blinfong model. I said, hey, there's bump mapping, there's texture mapping, and then we get the color. Well, it turns out that we can get more than color out of a fragment shader. So what else do you think a fragment shader could do or output that would be useful? General computation. So before CUDA, before OpenCL, we used to do all sorts of general computations in a fragment shader. We used to go textures. Well, they're not really textures for computer graphics. They're 2D matrices. And if we took two textures and then we rendered an image, and in each fragment for the image, we read one column of one matrix and one row of the other matrix, we can do that product, right? So you're right that we totally used to, and maybe some people still do use the fragment shader for just GPGPU. But what else? But that could still be under output color, only there the color is not a color. It's reinterpreted as just the value of the element. But what else do you think the fragment shader could output or not output? So let me show you a few. One is the fragment shader can throw away the fragment. It can just say, literally, the command is called discard. You do discard semicolon in GLSL. Or it might be called like kill in HLSL for Microsoft. It could discard the fragment and say, I don't want this anymore. Why? Why would I do that?
There's no light.
There's no
light. Assuming you're not using ambient.
Okay, sort of. Maybe no light. Okay, what do you think?
It's behind another fragment.
Behind another. So we could sort of implement a depth test in the fragment shader. I think it would be hard. From the OpenGL perspective, it would be kind of hard because of the synchronization. And your stuff, you may be able to do depth testing as part of the fragment shader, maybe, before or after. We'll talk about that. But you might just discard the fragment because, for example, say you're drawing a fence, and you don't want to draw the geometry for the fence. You might just draw two triangles, it's a quad for that fence, and you might have a texture that is the chains, the chain link for that fence, then you discard whenever there's an alpha of zero, right, in the texture. Does that make sense? Okay, so I can change the depth value when I output a fragment shader, which means, like, through rasterization and the transforms, we get a depth value that says how far away it is from the viewer, but I could change that in the fragment shader. Why would I want to do that? What type of shaders do you think would want to do that?
Normal maps?
Bump maps. Bump maps? So the bump map, remember, it doesn't change the geometry. It just changes the normal so that the lighting computation fakes the change in geometry. Displacement maps? So displacement maps, that's a good point. Everyone know what displacement maps are? So they're like bump maps or normal maps, only you're not doing them per fragment. You're actually displacing the geometry. So since you're displacing the geometry, you can't do a displacement map in the fragment shader because it's not operating on the vertices of the geometry, right? You'd have to do it much earlier. You can do a displacement map in the vertex shader. In fact, I showed that on Monday with the water. Do you guys remember the water example? I showed the flat water, and then I showed the one with the waves. Okay, so let me talk about something that I think is pretty interesting, and we've had final projects based on it and similar ideas. But say here's the viewer, and they're looking over here. We might do things where we render proxy geometry. Like say we render, I'm going to do the simplest possible thing I can come up with. Say I render a box. But I don't actually want to draw this box. What I want to do is I want to do a ray trace, and I want to ray trace with something inside the box. Like, for example, I might have a sphere. So the way I do this is in a fragment shader, I shoot a ray from the eye through the fragment, through the box. And then once I'm in the box, I can say, do I hit this sphere? And if I don't, then I would discard it. Now, if I do, my depth value would be wrong for the, because I don't want the depth value of the box. I want the depth value of the actual surface. Otherwise, it's not going to interact correctly with the depth test later in the scene. Now, this isn't the only use case. This is like the use case most familiar to me because I do this kind of stuff a lot. And here we're tracing an implicit surface for a sphere. But we may do all sorts of different types of ray tracing or ray marching as well, too, where you might have this voxel grid and you might march along it. And I hope for our hackathon, I hope to actually do that, where we're going to write fragment shaders that ray march distance functions to do like really cool rendering effects. And we had a student last semester who did, let me show you that real fast. And we're totally getting ahead of ourselves, but that is okay. So as you guys know, or do know now, I don't take down any of the previous semester websites. So you can go and look through years and years of 565 projects, and you can see how we keep up in the bar every time. And you guys will be at a new level. Although we've changed the second derivative has changed, where we're up in the bar for you guys more than we have in the past. Okay, so let's see. Oh, I don't want that. Show me the demo. There we go. Let's click on that. Okay, well, I don't have the actual live demo, but this scene right here, that's a city scene. This is actually has no geometry at all. This is just two triangles that are rendered. It's a viewport, two triangles aligned with the viewport, and we march a ray into the scene, and then based on a series of distance functions, we decide, hey, are we inside a building or outside a building? And then once we decide that we're at a building, we go, okay, are we on a window? Are we on brick? And so on, and do the shading. So this is just two triangles. And this thing scrolls over time. It's like an infinitely procedurally generated city. It's very, very cool. Got a lot of code can be found here. Got a lot of press on Twitter. In fact, this may be the most Twitter famous 565 project. It is unfortunately not running right now. Wow. Yeah, bummer. I don't know why it's not running, but and this is in WebGL too, which is awesome because you can just run it in your web browser, except for this demo, which is not working. Okay. Anyway, so fragment shader outputs. You could do color like we've been doing. You can discard. You can change the depth value if you want. You can also output multiple colors, so to speak, or just multiple values, and that can be useful for a technique called deferred shading, where the lighting model I'm talking about is called forward shading, where we're lighting fragments as they happen, as they are rasterized. But what can happen is a lot of objects can be behind other objects, and then we didn't need to light them because they were never shown. Right? So there's a technique called deferred shading, where instead of doing the lighting right now, what we do is we output all the information that we need to do the lighting, and we output these things into things called G buffers, which are just 2D arrays that are, you know, the size of the frame buffer. So we might output, for example, what we read from the texture map, call that the diffuse color. Then we might output the normal. Then we might output, you know, the specular component. And then in a full screen pass, like we're going to do image processing, we'll read from each of those G buffers and then do the lighting. That's called deferred shading, and that is on my list to talk about later in the semester in more detail. But the newer, and this also in Direct3D, you hear this called MRT, multiple render targets. And in OpenGL ES, I believe that you actually can't do multiple colors. I think you can only do one, because definitely in WebGL, which is what I've been using recently, you can only do one, and I'd love to have multiple ones. But definitely in desktop OpenGL, no problem. Cool, okay, so what questions do you have on fragment shaders? Fragment goes in, shaded fragment goes out. Demos. Let me show you a demo or two. Well, I'm going to have to switch back to the laptop, though. So again, I'm going to run RenderMonkey like I did on Monday. Did anyone download this RenderMonkey? It's from, if you just Google RenderMonkey, it's, and I also have the link down the bottom on that side. I'll bring it back up. You know, it's free from AMD, and you could download it and check it out. And you could even write some code in it if you want. But I'll just bring up one of these two demos I had. I'll bring up the NPR one. Okay, so NPR is non-photorealistic rendering. Again, yet another topic that I want to cover in more detail. And it's all about, let's switch to this guy. Instead of making renderings that are photorealistic, which is definitely like what we're all about doing in the ray tracer, or path tracer, when you start doing things like global illumination, color bleeding, depth of field, here we're trying to make things that are not photorealistic, and you'll see this in lots of games with like a cartoon style. One of the earliest ones was the Zelda Wind Waker, which was on, what was that on? Was that on GameCube, Wind Waker maybe? So here what they do is there's two things to this particular effect, both done in the fragment shader. One is the diffuse component, instead of using that for the lighting, the diffuse component is done to look up into a 1D texture that has kind of like hot and cold colors. So you have less kind of total number of colors in this palette here. And that's what gets you the shading. The other thing is these black lines are at the silhouettes. So that's when the back, from the perspective of the viewer, the silhouette is when the front face meets the back face. And there's tons of ways to find silhouettes. I believe this particular code here is checking the normal in screen space in the fragment shader and seeing when it flips. And when it flips, it shades it black. So these are two common things that you'll see in NPR, which is the tune shading followed by the silhouettes. NPR is a great topic for final projects, or I might even throw into an assignment some simple stuff. Like this shader is trivial. I mean, you could code it before the end of the class period. It's pretty simple. And then there's other fields for NPR that I know less about, like these hatch effects here, where you want to make something look like it's hand-drawn. And what they do here is they have a variety of these hatch pattern textures, and depending on the view angle, they switch. Like, see how you see all these horizontal lines? But then as I come over here, you start to see all these vertical lines. So, again, really cool area of computer graphics. And, I mean, I wish I had an excuse to do NPR stuff at my work. I can't come up with one yet. But you guys are students, so you have an excuse to do it. So if you're interested in NPR, I'd totally encourage you to do that. Okay, back to the slide. Okay, so that's about it I have to say for the fragment shader. So I want to jump into these per fragment tests. Because once we shade a fragment, it's not necessarily going to become a pixel. And I know we keep saying depth, 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 but there's also other tests besides the depth test that's in a modern pipeline. So what other tests do you think would be useful? What?
Clipping.
Okay, so the clipping is done earlier in the pipeline than right now, but there's a similar test to clipping. Do you know what that would be? Have you heard of the name? You might not. If they're not, as like when you look at like what I believe is covered in 460. Now, I remember I'm maybe a little out of touch. I took 460 as a student in 2006, and I remember pretty well. But from what I remember there, I don't think that the stage I'm thinking of is covered. Any other guesses that you think? Things that would be useful? Why would you want to discard a fragment? And then you might also, then you're going to start asking me, well, geez, you told me I can discard the fragment shader. Why are these tests here? And we will answer those tests. And well, I will probably turn the question around to you guys, but I will eventually get your answers. Okay, so I'm going to talk about three tests. One is the scissor test, which literally... Oops, I have a picture? Man, I don't even have a picture. These slides are bomb. They're total bummer slides. Okay, so one is the scissor test, which literally takes a rectangle in screen space. You know, so I thought I was drawn into this big window, but the scissor test gives me one rectangle and says, well, you only pass this test if the pixel is inside the rectangle. Okay, so it's like scissoring out, you know, literally, physically, I have scissors. And I'll tell you why the scissor test is useful. And then ask you if you think it is in the right spot in the pipeline. But it can be useful because we might be doing an expensive full screen effect, and it only needs to happen on a subset of the screen. So we figure out what that subset is, and then we put a, then we enable a scissor test over top of it. You're like, you know, I might do that once every 10 years. I do this thing all the time. I do it consistently. So here's an example. To do picking, if I have a mouse and the mouse is moving around and I want to know what object it's clicking on, usually the way you do that is you render to an off-screen buffer and you give each object a different color. And you render the entire scene and you read back and go, okay, well, what color was it and then what object was that? That's one. There's other ways to do picking, but that's one very common way to do it. And if you do that, you're shading all the fragments. You're doing the fragment work for all these guys and they're all going to the frame buffer. So what you can do is first you can change your view frustum such that it's just around that pixel, and that's good. But then the other thing you do is you put the scissor test just around that pixel too, so nothing else happens. And then a lot of times we have objects and we figure out their bounding volume, and then we project the bounding volume onto the near plane, create the scissor rectangle, then scissor it out. But the scissor test is kind of late in the pipeline the way I'm showing it here, and the way the GL spec says it is. So you might go, okay, fine, I get it. You make the scissor test, and we can save some performance because it looks like it wouldn't have to do some other tests. It wouldn't have to do this thing called blending, and it wouldn't have to write to the frame buffer. If it doesn't write to the frame buffer, that's less bandwidth, and less bandwidth is good. But you go, is it really worth it? Why couldn't I just do that in the fragment shader? Yes, you could. So why is the scissor test here? Why didn't we just get rid of it and go, well, geez, we could devote more transistors to some other stuff, or we could simplify the pipeline. And Patrick showed me that crazy picture of the pipeline, and there's so many stages, and we can get rid of this stage. So why do you think it still exists? Yep. So there's probably not a whole lot of hardware to support it, I would say, okay? But that's not the whole story. Maybe no hardware, no special hardware to support it. So there used to be something called the alpha test. And the alpha test looked at the alpha value coming out of the fragment shader and would decide what to do based on it. It might go, okay, all alpha values are fine. Or you might say, well, alpha values that are zero get discarded. Or alpha values that are less than 0.3 are discarded. But then we said, well, geez, we can do discard in the fragment shader, so let's just get rid of the alpha test. And if we do discard in the fragment shader, it might be at the top of our code in the fragment shader, so it's always going to be better than the alpha test because we can discard earlier in our code and therefore potentially execute less code. But this scissor test here is interesting because the scissor test doesn't have to happen here. The OpenGL spec says that this is where it is, but when you implement the spec, you're free to do whatever you want as long as the behavior conforms to the spec. And it just so happens that since a fragment shader doesn't, for now, we're going to say fragment shader has no side effects, you can move this scissor test all the way up around primitive assembly So that basically the clipping code that we talked about, the clipping region is just the union, or the, sorry, is the intersection of the clipping region and the scissor test. So the scissor test is actually free. You follow me? So that's why I, and what a, my long-winded speech here is based on my belief, not on like solid evidence, but I'm pretty sure that's the case on why it's still sticking around. Okay, so that's one simple test. The other test is called the stencil test. And the stencil test, I spent like 10 minutes last semester trying to discuss stencil shadow volumes, which are not that widely used anymore, so I'm skipping those 10 minutes. So if you were to compare these slides to last semester slides, they, you will not see the stencil shadow volumes. But in addition to the color buffer that's in the frame buffer and the color, that's the final colors of the output, there's also, you can also have a stencil buffer there. And this is used for stenciling out objects, so to speak, where for each color, there's a scalar value that is usually up to 8 bits, 0 to 255. And we can do things like say that when we're drawing this object, let's increase our stencil values. When we're drawing this object, let's decrease our stencil objects. Or even based on if the object is front, if the triangle is front facing or back facing, we can manipulate this test. And that's useful for scissoring out regions. So in one drawing pass, we draw and we manipulate the stencil buffer. And then in the next drawing pass, In the next drawing pass, we draw, but we say only draw if the stencil is a certain value. So one example of this is say you're playing a game and there's like goggles on it. You could stencil out the goggles, basically. You could render a pass where you stencil it out. And then you render the goggles first and you stencil and you say, okay, wherever the goggles are, it's 1. Everything else is 0. Then when you render the rest of the scene, your stencil test just says only render where it's 1. And now you don't have any of the extra frame buffer reads where it's outside of the region. And that's a very simple example. The stencil test is really put there for stencil shadow volumes, which is a shadowing technique based on extruding volumes from the light source through the object and then simulating ray tracing based on the stencil test. But it has a lot of fill rate. Basically, it generates a lot of rasterization overhead. And it is hard to get to work robustly. Like, for example, if a user enters the shadow volume. And the technique to do that is called Z-fail shadow, stencil shadows. And it's patented, actually. It's hilarious. Creative Labs, which is the company that made the Sound Blaster, if you guys are old enough to have had a Sound Blaster card, they patented the technique. But John Carmack from id, who did Wolfenstein and Doom, he like discussed the technique years before they patented it. So I'm not sure if the patent holds any weight or not. But it's an interesting piece of graphics history. Okay, cool. So and these again, when you look at your rasterization pipelines, we're really gonna ask, you're probably used to it at this point. We're going to ask for the minimal that you need to get something going, and then we're going to say do a few other stages. So if you don't like the stencil test or the scissor test, you don't have to do them. If you're looking for low-hanging fruit, I'd say the stencil test is a pretty easy test to do. The stencil would be a little bit harder, but you could do cooler stuff. And then you're going to have all these cool debug, your image is going to be really cool. You're going to have debug views where you just see the stencil buffer and so on. Okay, so let's talk about the depth test, and hopefully we can finish it before the class ends. And then fall break, Monday, right? Fall break, does that sound right? Okay, so there's no class, of course, on Monday. And then, let me check. Is it Halloween the next week? No. Okay, good. So then we'll be back here on the 24th, right? And I think that's a guest lecture, too. That sounds good. Is anyone who knows the schedule better than me? I think the 24th is the guest lecture from... What?
Your guest lecture's on the
29th. On the 29th. Oh, no, it's two. You guys are spoiled with guest lectures, I'm telling you. So the guest lecture from Eric Langell, who's talking about game engine design, that's on the 29th. That's on the Monday, so 2 weeks from this past Monday. But a week from now, Wednesday, Sean Lilly, who... previously took this class last semester, went to AMD and worked on shadows all summer, and then this semester he's doing an independent study along with a couple other students on sparse textures and gigavoxels, which is pretty awesome. And that I told him that might become a project in this class, although it's three students all semester, so one of you guys 2 weeks. What do you think? Fair? Reasonable? But he's going to give a guest lecture on shadows because at this point he knows more about shadows than I know because he spent a whole summer with them. So that's going to be really cool. And now as we're discussing that, we are running out of time to talk about the depth test. So, okay. That's going to be great for you guys. You will have two guest lectures. What I might do, though, just for the sake of your rasterizer, is a whole class tomorrow. During the guest lecture, during Sean's guest lecture, I'll probably spend maybe the first 5 or 10 minutes just finishing the pipeline so that you have seen the whole pipeline with still plenty of time to code your rasterization pipeline. Very cool. So have a good break, and I'll see you a week from now.